the first event that historically that happens, and actually the Psalms are kind of in a goofed up order historically, but we'll get to that later. But historically, the two events are the two, what we call the two captivities, the two times that nations come and wipe out the kingdom initially. The first event happens in 722 BC when the Assyrians come marching down and they're on their conquer the world campaign, and it's it's like World Super Bowl whatever, and they're trying to conquer the world, and they succeed in wiping out the northern kingdom, because at this time Israel has been split for years, hundreds of years, into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom called Israel and the southern kingdom called... I'm just checking to see if you're awake. Is anybody here awake? Judah. There you go. Good girl. All right. And the Assyrians wipe out the northern kingdom. This is during the days of Hezekiah. You can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 19. They will, in 2 Kings 17, they wipe out the entire northern kingdom, which is called Israel or Samaria. But when they get to the capital of the southern kingdom, when they get to Jerusalem, this incredible event happens. Hezekiah is calling the people together. They're praying. They're calling out on God. Isaiah the prophet's a part of it, and he's praying, and they're laying out all these taunts and threats before God, and God comes back with this word. And God says, you know what? They're not even going to shoot an arrow into this place. And you know what? I'm going to take care of it, God says. And actually, they come up twice. They come up the first time just to kind of rattle the swords and to get tough and to talk tough. And then they come back again. And God says, you know what? You don't have to worry about this. And they all go to bed. And when they get up in the morning, all the Assyrians are dead. 185,000 Assyrians have been camped out at their doorsteps. It sounds like when you get invaded by ants. Doesn't it sound like the ant thing? You know, have you ever had that? You wake up in the morning but usually when you wake up in the morning, the ants are crawling all over everything, right? Not that that ever, you know, whatever. I hear this happens. when King Hezekiah gets up in the morning, all the Assyrians are dead, and God has done a marvelous deliverance. This is one of the events that two of the Psalms will be written around. The two of them are written during the time of Hezekiah, after this marvelous deliverance. The other event is very similar. It will happen in 586 BC. The first and last Psalms that we'll look at will be written during this time period, the time that we call the Babylonian captivity. Another empire is going for the World Series. Another empire is trying to conquer the world. This time it's the Babylonians. They've already beaten the Assyrians, and now they're beginning their march into the Holy Land, into the Promised Land. The northern kingdom's already gone. All that's left is the southern kingdom of Judah. And once again, an enemy's at their doorstep. This time, God doesn't deliver them. And this time, there's a different outcome. The nation is wiped out. Some are carried captive off to Babylon, and many are killed. The city of Jerusalem, God's crown jewel, the apple of God's eye, the city is taken. The city is torn down. The temple, God calls it his footstool, the place where the ark is, it's torn down. Piece by piece, it's leveled. Two events. These are very similar events and with different outcomes. And that's kind of the background between these for these next four Psalms, starting in Psalm 74. Psalm 74 is going to be written during this latter period in 586 BC when the Babylonians have already conquered the city. It's called, the title says it's a maskil of Asaph. A maskil, meaning it's something to think about. There's a lesson in it. A maskil of Asaph. Asaph was one of David's worship leaders But this is written long after the time of David. Asaph, his sons and sons' sons and sons' 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 sons, they became kind of the main worship leaders in the temple. It was kind of a thing passed down from father to son. So it's this generation thing. It's this group that has written this psalm. Verse 1. O God, why hast thou cast us off forever? Why doth thine anger smoke against the sheep of thy pasture? Remember thy congregation, which thou hast purchased of old, the rod of thine inheritance, which thou hast redeemed, this Mount Zion, where thou hast dwelt. Zion is Jerusalem. That's Mount Zion is where the temple was built. It's the name of the hill. Verse 3, lift up thy feet unto the perpetual desolations, even all that the enemy hath done wickedly in the sanctuary. New Living Translation says, walk through the awful ruins of the city, see how the enemy has destroyed your sanctuary. Verse 4, thine enemies roar in the midst of the congregations. They set up their ensigns for signs. In other words, they've torn down everything Jewish, and now we've got all this got all these Babylonian billboards lining the streets and everything. It doesn't look like home. Verse 5. A man was famous as he had lifted up axes upon the thick trees, but now they break down the carved work thereof at once with axes and hammers. And probably the idea is just simply that, you know, these guys have come and mowed down the city like Paul Bunyan mows down the forest. Verse 7. They have cast fire into thy sanctuary. They have defiled by casting down the dwelling place of thy name to the ground. They said in their hearts, let us destroy them. They have burned up all the synagogues of God in the land. And probably the word synagogue is probably not an accurate translation. It's in the King James. But because technically, the technical term synagogue doesn't come until after the Babylonian captivity is over. That's when the actual, what we know as synagogues today, which is what our church is based on. Churches are based upon the Jewish synagogues. That doesn't happen until after the Babylonian captivity, but you don't probably aren't really worried about that, are you? Okay, verse 9. We see not our signs. There is no more any prophet, neither is there any among us that knoweth how long. We're so confused. Nobody can tell us what God's doing in all of this. Verse 10, O God, how long shall the adversary reproach? And shall the enemy blaspheme thy name forever? Why withdrawest thou thy hand, even thy right hand? Pluck it out of thy bosom. And this is like very depressing. Very depressing. This is a depressing psalm. This is not really one that you want to read when you want to cheer up before you go to bed. But on the other hand, it's very real, isn't it? You ever had days like this where it seems like your life is being torn apart and the enemy's running left and right all over you? Anybody? Anybody's had that? Yep, we've all had that. It's life. It's real. It's real. Verse 12. For God is my King of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters. Thou breakest the heads of Leviathan in pieces and gavest him to be meat to the people inhabiting the wilderness. Now, what he's doing, he's talking about historical things. He's going back to the time of Israel in the wilderness, how God brought them. Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. God parted the Red Sea. He's making himself think back to times when God has done big things. He's trying to remind himself of how big God is. Verse 15, thou didst cleave the fountain and the flood. Thou driedst up mighty rivers. In the wilderness, at one point, a couple of times, they ran out of water. And God caused water to come out of the rock. Thou driest up mighty rivers. When they came into the promised land, God stopped the Jordan River, and they were able to walk across on dry ground. The day is thine, the night also is thine. Thou hast prepared the light and the sun. Thou hast set all the borders of the earth. Thou hast made summer and winter. He's reminding himself of who God is, of all the things that God has done. Right now, everything's hopeless. And the best he can do is to remind himself of who God is. Verse 18. Remember this, that the enemy hath reproached, O Lord, and that the foolish people have blasphemed thy name. O deliver not the soul of thy turtledove unto the multitude of the wicked. Forget not the congregation of thy poor forever. Have respect unto the covenant, for the dark places of the earth are full of the habitations of cruelty. O let not the oppressed return ashamed. Let the poor and needy praise thy name. Arise, O God, plead thine own cause. Remember how the foolish man reproacheth thee daily. Remember what they're saying about us, God. Forget not the voice of thine enemies. The tumult of those that rise up against thee increaseth continually. Forget not the voice of thine enemies. So what's the psalmist doing? He wants God to help him. He wants God to deliver them. And he's thinking back to the mighty things that God has done in the past. The psalmist wants God to take away his problems. I'm hitting you with a negative stuff up front. Okay, I'm glad this is the first psalm. He's asking God to deliver him from his problems. Is God going to do that? I would tend to say no. We looked at two different situations at the very beginning, kind of tried to set the stage. Two different situations, the Assyrians and the Babylonians, both coming up against Jerusalem. With the Assyrians, God wipes them out overnight. With the Babylonians, they tear the city apart. I think sometimes we fall into a trap of thinking that God's like a magic genie and I rub my magic lamp three times and my problems will go away. And you know what? Do you remember when we studied through the book of Job? You remember that? It doesn't work that way, does it? We want him to deliver us. We can cry out. We can remember the past. We can remember what God has done in the past. That's okay. That's good to encourage you. And we'll see that again in another psalm, and we'll make a lesson out of it a little bit when we get there. But right now, I just kind of want to say this. You know what? God doesn't always take problems away. Though sometimes he will deliver us from our problems, sometimes he chooses to deliver us through our problems. And this psalm is a solemn reminder of that. God is at work in our lives. And sometimes he chooses, this thing is driving me nuts. It's just like the clip. Pull this thing. It's flesh colored. Greg says it's so I can put it up here. Should I put it up here? if I turn it around like this? That's not distracting, is it? It doesn't distract me. Oh, yeah, I can feel it. We're working on this. We're working on... Put it on my nose. Ouch! Lil, you are a funny girl. Okay. How's that? Is that going to work? That works. No, I'm not going to stick it in my ear. Okay. Let's... Psalm 75. Let's move on. Psalm 75. For the next two psalms, we're going to move to the time of Hezekiah, when the Assyrians are on the doorstep. Psalm 75 to the chief musician, Altashkith. A psalm of Asaph. Again, another one of these Asaph psalms. Verse 1. Unto thee, O God, do we give thanks. Unto thee do we give thanks, for that thy name is near, thy wondrous works declare. And I got to tell you, Psalm 75 and 76 are written probably, most likely, after the deliverance. Okay, it's already happened. It's already happened. Verse 2. When I shall receive the congregation, I will judge uprightly. Better translation, New American Standard. When I select an appointed time, it is I who judge with equity. A little completely different. King James is the only one that does this congregation deal in there. The modern translations all have this, carry this idea. When I select an appointed time, it is I who judge with equity. You know, the previous psalm, now, these are written in different times. So you don't think that one necessarily follows the other. In fact, the one we're reading now was written before the other one. But there are times when we're asking the question that the previous psalm asked. How long, O Lord? When is this going to be over? And one of the answers is right here. It will be over when God says it is. At the appointed time, when God says, it will be over. And He will judge correctly. He will do what's right. For the folks living in 586 BC, saying, how long, O Lord? You know what? It wasn't time. They weren't going to be rescued from the Babylonians. In 722, they were. What's the difference? Well, there's a lot of differences. But the bottom line is that it's when God says it's over. It's over when God says it's over. Verse 3. The earth and all the inhabitants thereof are dissolved. I bear up the pillars of it. God holds up the earth. I said unto the fools, do not deal foolishly. And to the wicked, lift not up the horn. Lift not up your horn on high. Speak not with a stiff neck. Now, we might say, well, I mean, what's this horn thing? We might say, well, don't toot your own horn. I think that's probably a good way to look at it. It's not quite an exact translation of ideas between the Hebrew and all. But God's saying to proud people, don't be so puffed up. Don't be so proud. Verse 5, verse 6. Let's go back to verse 5. Lift not up your horn on high. Speak not with a stiff neck. Don't be so proud. For promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. If you look at the people... in Hezekiah's day, you know, God's going to take care of what God's going to do. God's going to put one down. God's going to lift up another one up. And you need to be careful that you aren't caught up in pride. But there's some pretty cool, verse 6 and 7 is a pretty cool promise. Promotion isn't going to come from people. And you know what? In Hezekiah's day, we're talking about God delivering them. That's the promotion. But it's not going to come from people. It's going to come from God. And do you notice it says in verse 6, it doesn't come from the east, nor the west, nor the south. Is there something missing? North. Why doesn't it talk about north? Well, I can give you a couple ideas. One is that one suggestion is he doesn't say north because that's the direction the Assyrians are coming from. And your deliverance is going to come from the north because that's where the attack is coming from. That's one suggestion. The other suggestion, I like the other suggestion, is that the north is representative of God. The sacrifice was supposed to be done on the north side of the altar. In Isaiah 14:13, God's throne is described as being in the north. In Psalm 48, verses 1 and 2, great is the Lord, greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of His holiness. Beautiful for situation, joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the sides of the north, the city of the great King. I don't understand it. I don't think I can tell you why God lives in the north. That's what some people thought. And so maybe the suggestion is that God is going to bring deliverance from the north. Promotion doesn't come from the north, from the east or west or the south, but it comes from God. Verse 7, God is the judge. He putteth down one and he setteth up another. Let's look at Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, verse 22. God's going to take care of promotion. God's going to take care. That's what I like about the King James here. I like that word, promotion. God's going to take care of promotion. Colossians 3:22 says, "Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh." Now, you might be thinking to yourself, "I'm not a servant. I work for a living. I get paid." Well, think about your job. For a second. Now, what? You don't think that's you're being a servant? You're not a slave? Of course you're a slave. You just get paid for being a slave, okay? You have masters according to the flesh. A lot of you in here have a job. You know what this is, what we're talking about here. You have a boss. And he says, "Servants or slaves, obey in all things your bosses according to the flesh." Obey your human masters, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. Paul's writing to the Colossians and he's saying, look, guys, you ought to do a good job for your boss, not for your boss's sake, not because your boss is watching you. Don't just do a good job when your boss is around. But do a good job for God's sake. And whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. But he that doeth wrong shall receive for the wrong which he hath done, and there is no respect of persons. You're going to get your reward from the Lord. Sometimes the reward is what you're going to get in heaven. Sometimes the reward is what God will work out in getting you promoted. There's going to be times where God wants you to be the hardest working person at your job. He wants you to be the best employee because you've got His name written all over you. And you know what? He'll take care of the promotions. He'll take care of the raises. And there's going to be times where you're working for a jerk, total jerk. And we think, God, how come I'm not getting promoted? How come so-and-so, kissed up to the boss and he's getting the promotion? That's not fair. Your promotion isn't going to come from your boss. It's going to come from God. Do your work to please the Lord. He'll take care of the promotion. He will take care of the promotion. Promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another. Verse 8, back in Psalm 75. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red, it is full of mixture, and he poureth out of the same, but the dregs thereof, all the wicked of the earth, shall wring them out and drink them. But I will declare forever, I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. All the horns of the wicked also will I cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be exalted. Okay, this last little bit here in verse 8, this thing about the cup. In God's hand, there's a cup, and he describes this cup as being filled with wine. And it mentions dregs. Dregs is in the old days when they made wine, and they danced in the wine vat, and they dun da dun da dun da dun dun da dun, and they squish in the wine, the grapes and stuff, and they make all the. They didn't have nice little sieves to sift all the grape pieces and the chunks and the little grape skins and stuff. They didn't have sieves to get all that stuff out. And so when they, and then when they would, they take the grape juice and they would stick it in things like leather bags of wine skins, we'd call it, and that's how they would ferment in there. But it's still got all the silt in the bottom or the dregs, and that was the bitter part. Fine wine they would pour it from one vessel to another. And leave the dregs in the old vessel and try to do that kind of thing. But what he's describing here is that God's got a cup of wine in his hand, and God's going to serve up the dregs, all the junk, the silt, the sour stuff, to the nations of the world. I believe what he's talking about is God's judgment, God's wrath. That's what the cup is all about. It's a picture that's very common in Scripture. Look at Revelation 14, verse 9. Revelation 14, verse 9. Now, this is something that's going to be happening around the corner in a few years during the time of the tribulation period. Revelation 14, 9, it says, "And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever. They have no rest day or night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name.'" Now, this is talking about those people who, during the tribulation period, will get this mark, this 666 thing, whatever it is. And again, we mentioned that last Wednesday that it's keyed to the worship of the Antichrist. It's not just having this number, but it's the number and worshiping the beast. They go hand in hand. They will go hand in hand. And those people who will make that choice, they will drink of the cup of the wrath of God, the wine of God's wrath. They will taste God's wrath. In Revelation 14, verse 17, you'll see the same kind of a picture. Chapter 14, verse 17, it says, "Another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle, and another angel came out from the altar, which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, 'Thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even under the horses' bridles by the space of 1,600 furlongs." This great winepress of the wrath of God. Again, the same concept of wine being tied to God's wrath. Jesus, in the night before he was crucified, was in the garden. And you remember one of the things that he prayed? He said, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, whatever, you know, I'll do whatever you want." We can look at this cup as being, you know, his lot, his purpose in life. But also, it's a cup of God's wrath. Because God would be pouring out on Jesus the penalty for our sins. You back up a few hours prior to that, and Jesus was sitting at a table with his disciples, and he took a piece of bread and broke it up in pieces and handed it around and said, "Let this remind you of my body, which will be broken for you." And then he took the cup. He said, "This is the cup of the new covenant, my blood, We do that. We talk about this every time we take communion, don't we? Jesus has given us a cup that reminds us of the cup He drank. And there's a sense that when we take communion, we remember that God poured His wrath on Jesus for our sake. Now, back in Psalm 75, it says, you know, it's talking about the writer is talking about how God has taken these people through this time, this horrible time, and God has brought His judgment on the Assyrians. And he says, God is the, verse 7, God is the judge. He putteth down one and He setteth up another. God does this. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red, and it is full of mixture, and He poureth out the same. But the dregs thereof, all the wicked of the earth, shall wring them out and drink them. They've just seen the Assyrians do that. They've seen that the Assyrians drink of God's wrath. God will take care of it. Psalm 76. To the chief musician on Neganoth, a psalm or a song of Asaph. Psalm 76 is also written at the same time as Psalm 75. So we're still talking about Hezekiah's day. Verse 1. In Judah is God known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem, or Jerusalem, also is His tabernacle and His dwelling place in Zion. There brake He the arrows of the bow, the shield, and the sword, and the battle. Selah. They've just watched God do this. They've just watched God take out 185,000 Assyrians in one night. Verse 4, Thou art more glorious and excellent than the mountains of prey. The stout-hearted are spoiled. They have slept their sleep, and none of the men of might have found their hands. These guys went to sleep, and they didn't wake up. And Jerusalem woke up, and they were all dead. Verse 6, At Thy rebuke, O God of Jacob, both the chariot and the horse are cast into a deep sleep. Where do we want to stop? Verse. Okay, keep going. Verse 7. Thou art to be feared, and who may stand in thy sight when once thou art angry? Thou didst cause judgment to be heard from heaven. The earth feared and was still when God arose to judgment to save all the meek of the earth. Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain. New Living Translation says, human opposition only enhances your glory. Which says, the wrath of man shall praise thee. Human opposition only enhances God's glory, for you use it as a sword of judgment. The New International says, surely your wrath against men brings you praise. And the survivors of your wrath are restrained. Sometimes God can even use people who oppose Him for His glory. There was a fellow about 100 years ago. His name was Robert Ingersoll, and he was a famous atheist. And at one point, he was a well-known speaker. He drew large crowds. One night after a speech in which he severely attacked a Christian man's faith, he dramatically took out his watch and he said, I'll give God a chance to prove that He exists and is almighty. I challenge Him to strike me dead within 5 minutes. And so there was silence. And the people were kind of a little fidgety about what was going to happen. And some people left the hall. They were unable to take the strain of the occasion. One woman fainted. At the end of the allotted time, the atheist exclaimed, he said, see, there is no God. I am still alive. I'm still very much alive. After the lecture, a young fellow said to a Christian lady, well, Ingersoll certainly proved something tonight. Her response was memorable. Yes, he did, she said. He demonstrated that even the most defiant sinner cannot exhaust the patience of the Lord in just 5 minutes. The wrath of man shall praise thee. Sometimes God can even use a person who opposes him, and he can use it for his glory. Verse 11, vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared. He shall cut off the spirit of the princes. He is terrible to the kings of the earth. Or he's a God to be feared. These people have been through this incredible time. I believe it says in Kings that after this time, the fame of Hezekiah grew. All the nations round about started giving presents. They thought this was 185,000 people dead on his doorstep. We want Hezekiah to be our friend. You know, we don't want to be his enemy. We're not going to attack you, Hezekiah. Don't you have to worry about this. And the world got a huge demonstration of the power of God. And one of the things that the psalmist says in verse 11 is, you know what? You need to make promises to God, and you need to keep your promises. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared. When you understand who God is, how awesome he is, how fearsome he is, how, again, King James would say, how terrible he is, you need to get your life in line. And when you make promises to God, keep your promises. Pay your vows. Keep your promises. I was reading about a fellow named Dale Webster. Does anybody know the name Dale Webster? You do? You know the name? Do you know the name? He's a famous surfer. He lives up in... Do you know this name? You've heard the name, but you don't have a clue what it is. Yeah, I agree with that. He's a fellow that lives up near Bodega Bay. I'll just read this to you. It says, with dreary weather and water temperatures down to 53 degrees, no one would say it's a perfect day for surfing at Salmon Creek Beach, Bodega Bay, Northern California. Nevertheless, Dale is there out in the ocean, sliding and dancing between the waves like he's steadily done for the past 25 years. Actually, to be precise, well, this article was written October 15th, 2000. To be precise, 9,175 days straight. They call him Daily Wavester. He's surfing every day since September 2nd, 1975, when Bodega Bay Surfers Disneyland had a fantastic 15-foot waves week. I surfed the first day and then the second. I surfed all 7 days. And then I thought, let me see if I can keep this going. And here he's after an uninterrupted lifespan of surfing at the beach at the end of his daily surfing session, dripping cold water from his 5 millimeters thick wetsuit, not to mention gloves. Talking about his goal. His goal is to surf every day, catch at least 3 waves every day for the complete 28-year lunar cycle. This is what he's like hooked into. And he will finish this in February of this year. So the guy has just got, he's got like one more month to go. And he's 55 years old now. His big disappointment, the Guinness Book of Records doesn't accept any new entries but those that beat a previous record. And since there's nothing like this already in the files, it's likely he won't see his name published. Talks about a well-paid job is probably his biggest regret. Being tied to such a daily schedule has forced him to quit jobs when they interfered with surfing. Yeah, dude. So far, the only reward he has achieved is a free wetsuit supply from the manufacturer O'Neill. Since he's done such a good advertisement for durability and a kind of wisdom which very likely comes from all that time spent amidst pure nature offshore in the water. In the meanwhile, he keeps going and counting. The very last day will number 10,407. While people around him get inspiration for his endurance, his daughter, Margot, 13, has never missed a day of school so far. She's also been surfing since she was 3, but not every day. How's that for commitment? The guy made a promise to himself, or else the god of surfing. I don't know. Is there a god of surfing? I don't know. Every day for 28 years, day in and day out, I read that he's done this through kidney stones. When he had kidney stones, his wife pushed him on the board out to the waves while he struggled to get on the board and ride his 3 waves. He has missed weddings, funerals, important things. I think his son, he missed his son's wedding because surfing was more important to hold on to this thing. We kind of laugh at it and kind of go, wow. But if a guy can be that committed to surfing, how about us in our commitment to the Lord? When we think about who God is, how awesome He is, all that He's done for us, you know, go ahead and make your promises to the Lord and keep them. And if you've broken them, get back at it. Get back at it. Because we serve an awesome God. An awesome, awesome God. Let's go back to the psalm. I've got one more psalm. Psalm 77. Now, we've gone from the Babylonian captivity. That was the first psalm, Psalm 74, when they got wiped out. Then we've gone 2 psalms where we've talked about during the time of Hezekiah and God delivered them from the Assyrians. And now we're going to go back, move forward in time back to this. We're going to go back to the future, back to the Babylonian captivity again when they did get wiped out. And so we're going back into the dreadful, dreary time. Okay? Psalm 77. To the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and He gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My soul ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. It says, I remembered God and was troubled. Doesn't seem like God was going to deliver them. And He didn't. Verse 4. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart. And my spirit made diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will He be favorable no more? Is His mercy clean gone forever? Doth His promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath He in anger shut up His tender mercies? And then it says Selah. Selah means pause. Stop and think about this. Let there be a little instrumental solo here or something. But stop and think about this. From verse 9 to verse 10, things will change. The tone of the psalm will change. I don't know if we went from a minor key to a... We're going to go to a major key, but we're going to have a major change in the psalm. From one of the most depressing things you could ever write, suddenly it's going to be a whole lot different. And it happens at this pause. Things can change. Attitudes can change if you and I would learn to pause. And take a little time, maybe be a little quiet. You know, there's some goofy, funny little English things that you can play around that just kind of illustrate this. The phrase, God is nowhere.
God is nowhere. That's kind of the way that this psalm starts. God is nowhere. Where are you, God? God is nowhere.
Well, if you write down this, play along with me. If you've got a pencil and paper, write that down. God is nowhere. Okay? Write that down. God is nowhere. Now, if you stick a pause in there, it changes. Stick a pause on the last word between the letters W and H. Go ahead, stick it in. Stick a little pause. Put a slash in there. And what do you have? God is now here. What's the difference? You stick a pause in it. It's where you stick the pause. Here's another one. Here's another one. Write these words down. Woman. Without. Write these words down. Woman. Without. Her. Man. Is. Nothing. Okay? Now, just look at that for a second, and here's your assignment. Stick some pauses in there. How would you phrase this? Put some punctuation in this sentence. Okay? Woman without her man is nothing. Okay? You got an idea of how you're going to punctuate this? Okay? This is done in a university, and the way men typically do this, men put the pauses like this. Woman, comma, without her man, comma, is nothing. That's how the men punctuate this. Woman, without her man, is nothing. Here's how the women typically punctuate it. You got it? Woman, without her, man is nothing. See, it works, it works. It depends where you put the pause. It changes when you put a pause in. When life is falling apart, it's important that we take a pause. And then we put a pause into it. Because the whole thing changes. It can change. Maybe the circumstances might not change, but your outlook can change. And so he sticks this little selah in him. God, have you forgotten us? Verse 10. Psalm 77, verse 10. And I said, This is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Stop here for a second. There's something I ran right by. Verse 12. I will meditate also of all thy works and talk of all thy doings. There's two things that he mentions here in verse 12. Meditate and talk. I will meditate also of all thy work. And secondly, I will talk of thy doings. I will meditate of all thy work to think about what God has done. God isn't always going to bring you through deliverance like he did the Assyrians. Sometimes he's going to sometimes we're going to go through difficult times like they went with the Babylonians. But we need to think about what God has done for us. There's an old hymn. It goes like this. When upon life's billows you are tempest-tossed, when you are discouraged, thinking all is lost, count your many blessings, name them one by one, and it will surprise you what the Lord hath done. Are you ever burdened with a load of care? Does the cross seem heavy you are called to bear? Count your many blessings. Every doubt will fly, and you will be singing as the days go by. Think about the things that God has done in the past. Think about who He is. Think back on the cross. Think what God has done for you. meditate on His work. But then He says, secondly, talk of thy doings. Talk about God. Talk about the goodness of the Lord. Get out of depression by giving out in ministry. Get out of depression by giving out in ministry. Sometimes the thing that breaks the darkness is getting out of yourself. Get away from dwelling on your circumstances and talk to somebody else about the Lord. Verse 13. He says, "Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God?" In other words, we learn about God when we go to church. We could apply it that way. "Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary." That's what you do when you come here. You know, we're learning about God's Word. We spend time worshiping Him and opening His Word and just studying about Him. And "Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary." We learn about You, God, when we're in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Verse 14, "Thou art the God that doest wonders. Thou hast declared Thy strength among the people." Verse 15, "Thou hast with Thine arm redeemed Thy people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph." Now, He's going to start going back to the past, just like He did earlier in the previous psalm, back in Psalm 74. "The waters saw Thee, O God, and the waters saw Thee, they were afraid. The depths also were troubled." And He's talking about the Red Sea. Isn't that interesting? I don't know where they crossed the Red Sea. But there's this plane that went down, this Egyptian aircraft that just went down. And they're talking about they found one of the flight recorders, but it's down so low they can't send divers to it. And I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking like, you know, and they cross, you know, I don't know, I'm sorry, crossing the Red Sea, and I just, you know, half a mile of water on either side. I don't know, I'm just sorry. I just kind of, oh well, go on, move on. Sorry. Isn't that cool? Yeah, wow. "The waters saw Thee, O God, the waters saw Thee, they were afraid. The depths also were troubled. The clouds poured out water. The skies sent out a sound, and Thine arrows also went abroad. The voice of Thy thunder was in the heaven. The lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. Thy way is in the sea, and Thy path in the great waters. Thy footsteps are not known. Thou ledest Thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron." Now, he's thinking back to the things that God has done in the past. And he's thinking about how God brought them through the Red Sea and what God has done. In verse 13, put your finger on verse 13 and put your finger down in verse 19. In verse 13, it says, "Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary." In verse 19, it says, "Thy way is in the sea, and Thy path in the great waters, and Thy footsteps are not known." Your way is in the sanctuary. And then he says, no. Your way is in the sea. And we're talking about the Red Sea, about how God parted the Red Sea. We learn principles when we come to church. And I try my best to talk about the things we need to apply to our lives, and we all, you know, you're all taking notes and all this kind of stuff, and we think about, you know, we're learning about God, but we really learn about Him when we go through the Red Sea. We really learn about Him when we take the things we've learned in the sanctuary and we put them on the bottom of our feet and walk through the Red Sea and walk through the circumstances that God has put upon our life. That's when we really learn. Is when it becomes real. It's not just, I don't just become a Bible hound and I know all the Bible verses and I can quote all the Bible verses, but but I don't really have a clue what it does in my life. No, God wants to use, God wants to teach me in the circumstances of my life. Just quote, just close with this last little bit by Spurgeon. It says this: those who would be in health do not sit still in their houses to breathe such air as may come to them, but they walk abroad and seek out rural and elevated spots that they may inhale the invigorating breezes. In other words, if you want to, you know, he's saying, you know, if you want to be healthy, you get out and go on your daily walk. Just get out of the house, you know. That sounds like Winston Churchill, not Charles Spurgeon. Okay, sorry. I confused my accent. Well, I don't know, but who knows that maybe that's how Churchill learned was from Spurgeon. I don't know. Thus, those godly souls who would be in a vigorous spiritual state do not merely think on whatever holy doctrines might come into their minds in the ordinary course of thought, but they give time to meditation. They walk abroad in the fields of truth and endeavor to climb the heights of gospel promises. It is said that Enoch walked with God. Here is not an idle but an active communion. The road to bodily health is said to be a footpath, and the way to spiritual health is to exercise oneself in holy contemplation, but to take what you learn and to go out and live it. He says, thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary, but he also says, thy way is in the sea. Through the real difficult things that I know that many of you have gone through, that's where we learn his ways. That's where we know him. Let's stand and pray.